We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shootings, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Yeah, and the destiny of civilization. In our elementary schools, history was shown to be a straight line, progress carrying us ever forward as old things are left behind. Well, our teachers were wrong. William Faulkner was right when he said the past is never dead. It's not even past. For example, as regular listeners to this show can attest, I argue that the First World War did not really end with the armistice. That war goes on and on. The issues were not resolved and continue to affect the world to this day. Similarly, the 1960s technically ended a long time ago, but we have not at all left them behind. For example, the Grateful Dead are now a well-established icon in American culture. The mainstream has moved. What was then called a counterculture is now deeply ingrained in the American culture of the late 20-teens. And it's sure not going away. The political movements of the 60s clearly have been less successful in transforming our country. But in terms of the culture war, does anyone doubt we won? Our 60s values, community, sexual liberation, freedom of expression, respect and appreciation for all cultures, and the end of American military dominance. Oh, wait, we're not quite there yet. Well, no one could have imagined we'd be where we are, not with the truly bizarre, reactionary, plutocratic presidency of Donald Trump. We had some sense of optimism back then. But perhaps like Republicans who for decades focused on destroying FDR's New Deal as their raison d'etre, I wonder if the psychedelic world we got to see in the late 60s is a motivating force behind the assaults on such things as reproductive rights, respect for all cultures, artistic freedom, and of course, stepping up militaristic imperialism everywhere, including here in America itself. I would argue that the 60s are not at all dead. That so-called 60s values are more applicable for today's challenges than ever. Well, I am very pleased to have with us as guest on today's Keeping Democracy Alive an icon of the 60s counterculture, one of the central figures, along with Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, in the creation of the Youth International Party, or YIPPY, Paul Krassner. Paul Krassner, thanks so much for being with us today on Keeping Democracy Alive.
I'm here.
Called one of the comic geniuses of the 20th century, Paul Krassner published The Realist from 1958 all the way to 2001. But when People magazine labeled him father of the underground press, he immediately demanded a paternity test. And when Life magazine published a favorable article about him, the FBI sent a poison pen letter to the editor calling Krassner a raving, unconfined nut. George Carlin responded, "The FBI was right. The man is dangerous and funny and necessary." While abortion was legal, Krassner ran an underground referral service. And as an anti-war activist, he became co-founder of the Yippies. Krassner's one-person show won an award from the L.A. Weekly. He received an ACLU award for dedication to freedom of expression. And at the Cannabis Cup in Amsterdam, he was inducted into the Counterculture Hall of Fame. He's won awards from the Feminist Party Media Workshop, and in 2010, the Oakland branch of the writers' organization PEN honored him with their Lifetime Achievement Award, and he is still alive, which is a good thing. Well, again, Paul Krassner, thanks so much for being with us today. You have a unique position in history. There's a lot to talk about. Let's start with satire. It seems a lot of people these days really don't know what satire is. When they see it, it confuses them. In the late 50s and early 60s, we kids treasured our Mad magazine, which was filled with satire. It's all about satire. Did it serve a valuable cultural purpose? And what about your magazine, The Realist? Why were such things important at their time? And what about the role of satire?
Well, you know, my own slogan was not the slogan so much as my credo, which was to communicate without any kind of compromise. And this was before the internet, and at that point, there were no adult satire magazines. The only thing going on was Mad Magazine, which was for teenagers, essentially. There was no satirical magazines for the realists, except that. And so I had to make it up as it go along. I had no way to compete with anybody. There was no competition. So, and what I did was I also published journalistic articles that had been rejected by by mainstream magazines, and so people started sending those articles to me and cartoons, and Steve Allen was the first one to subscribe to it, and he sent several subscriptions to friends. Lenny Bruce was one of those friends, and he sent several subscriptions to other people, and so it like Malthusian. It just was word of mouth, which is the best kind of advertising because it's free.
And people believe it.
Satire and fake news are the same thing, except that on one hand, fake news can be mean spirited, satire is you want to make people laugh. So it was. I'll give you an example.
Please do.
I covered the Patty Hearst trial, and but before her trial, when she was on the lam, I did in a magazine. I did an article, a fake questionnaire with Patty Hearst, and you know, but it, I made it sound as real as possible, but it was a satire. I made it up. That was fake news, but it was also satire. Two sides of the same coin. And so the FBI, they had to go through the motions. They saw that article, and they came to my house, and and they said, "Is Patty in your house?" I said, "No." They said, "Well, can we take a look?" And I said, "Do you have a search warrant?" And they said, "No." I said, "Well, I'm sorry, I can't let you in." So they went. They peeked through my window, but they was kind of smirking because they kind of knew that it wasn't real, but they had to go through the motions. So it was both fake news and satire. The current administration in at the White House, they keep saying what newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post that they're fake news,
right.
And all of the supporters of Donald Trump, they just immediately believe everything he says. It's like a cult.
Yeah, it very much is, and I wonder if fake news. Is satire sort of real, intentional fake news? I mean, it sounds like it is intentionally fake news. I can't imagine that the Trump team could have taken inspiration from your work with The Realist because, you know, it was obviously satire. It was funny. But and you have one of your great quotes among many. You say, "Truth is silly putty." What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm sure that a lot of your listeners don't know what silly putty.
Oh, that's a good point.
But it was a kind of you could it was sort of like clay, but soft clay, and if you pressed it on, let's say a comic strip,
yes,
it would become printed on the silly putty, and it was very popular at that point, and so it just seemed like an accurate thing that because you could squeeze it in different ways, and so I just thought that truth is silly putty because it was just a good image, I thought.
Yeah, and certainly history can be written and is written from all different points of view, and it's not necessarily wrong, it's just different points of view. And truth is, as you say, it can be bent and shaped intentionally, not on purpose, but satire, I think, plays a unique role in just bringing it to question, like that we as citizens have to question what's real out there. And I think that's one of the great things that The Realist did. I certainly used to enjoy reading that magazine. And you also mentioned Lenny Bruce. You were friends with the legendary man, Lenny Bruce. What did him in, do you think? I mean, we all know, you know, that heroin killed him. But what did him in? What were the forces at work on there? And how should Lenny Bruce be seen from today's vantage point, especially as we talk about making fun of power?
Well, the thing is that I had been assigned by Playboy magazine, which was going to serialize Lenny's autobiography, How to Talk Dirty and Influence People. And they hired me to edit Lenny's book, and it was his autobiography. I mean, I didn't ghostwrite or anything.
Right.
I just worked as his editor. And in the process, going to different cities with him, we became friends. Lenny was unlike the comedians that in those times, he broke through the tradition. The tradition was there'd be jokes about mothers-in-law,
yes,
about Asian drivers,
ooh,
about what else kind of things, airplane food, you know, all of those things. Lenny did satire about really important things, whether nuclear testing, the terrible salaries for teachers, abortion rights. These were all things that were taboos. He broke one taboo after another.
Yeah,
Racism. So people who had this sense of irreverence, this was a wonderful comedian to them, whereas others said, oh, he's a sick comic. He wrote a few articles for The Realist, the thing is that when I met him, he wanted to know how he would see the letters, the four-letter words that were taboo then,
right,
but I printed them out. Other magazines would just have asterisks or dashes, but the Supreme Court had ruled that obscenity had to have aroused prurient interest.
Right.
And this was in Lenny's hotel when he visited New York, and called me up, and I went to meet him at his hotel, and he said, And I told them about prurient interest was the Supreme Court's ruling. And so Lenny opened his suitcase on his bed there in the hotel room, and in this suitcase was a huge unabridged dictionary. And he looked up prurient, and at first it sort of said something like tickling or itching. But then he saw that it was the arousing of sexuality, and he said, "Well, what's wrong with that? You know, why should prurient interest not be allowed?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just if it was just the biology of it all, and." So he went. He brought copies of the issue, which had a letter from my lawyer explaining this, that there was nothing that there was nothing obscene even by the Supreme Court's ruling, and so he asked me to give out copies of that issue of The Realist in front of Town Hall, where he was going to perform. And he took it on stage and read from it, and it was his favorite magazine, and
nice.
He was my favorite comedian, so it was mutual.
And it does seem my impression is that the cultural pressures on him, he was pushing the envelope, as it were, too far, and that's kind of what did him in. And you know, certainly ahead of his time. I mean, the work that he does this compared to today, that's not obscene at all. But he was pushing the envelope in a way, kind of heroic, I think. If you just go ahead.
You know, he when he started being arrested one after another, it was for obscenity, The reason, but the real reason was not for anything that he said, except when he talked about one of his targets, his satirical targets, were organized religion, and that's really what got him in trouble. But there was no laws then for blasphemy, and so they had to have an excuse by saying that he did this obscenity. And it would be happen in Atlantic City in New Jersey, and then it would they would hear about it. District attorneys in other cities, in San Francisco and Los Angeles, and one after another. One year he got 15 arrests, and it was and. Other nightclubs were afraid. This was before they had regular comedy clubs, and they would be afraid to book him because they thought that they were threatened with the Vice Squad, that they would see that their nightclub license for liquor they would lose it. And so they stopped booking him, and his income came down, and he had to deal with district attorneys. It was not a happy time for him, but yet he understood. He knew that the cops and that the district attorneys, they were doing their job and trying to push their own career.
Yeah.
And so he just knew he loved the law and the First Amendment.
Yes.
And that's what he was fighting for. And ultimately, became posthumously, after he died, they had petitions that he could that made him a that he was not a criminal, and now decades later, you never see any comedian who has to worry about being arrested on stage, and they can't believe that it used to be that way.
Well, that's what we need in history, people to take some chances, to be genuinely brave, to push things a little bit, to shake things up. And, you know, art is not making, it's not about making people comfortable. It's about shaking things up. And I think, and that's one of the things that humor does. And certainly in the early days of the anti-war movement and the SDS, the Students for Democratic Society, it wasn't a lot of fun. They had long meetings, and they'd argue over what would end up being great volumes that no one could read. Yippie came out of that because it was fun. I wonder, you know, if you could talk about the birth of Yippie, what it was about, and the point that it was. And go ahead.
Yeah, let me just put it in this context, though, because George Carlin, he talked about how his way of performing was to go as far as he could to say whatever he wanted to, and see what the line is. And then he said, and then he crossed that line.
Right.
And just recently, Kathy Griffin, she got in trouble for holding up as if Donald Trump had been beheaded, and CNN they got scared.
Yeah. And they dropped her
because they wouldn't let her on anymore. She couldn't go with Anderson Cooper on New Year's. She was just banned from CNN.
Yeah.
And so she got very apologetic.
Yes.
And she said just what that George Carlin said, and she said that I walked to that line.
Yes.
But she didn't pass over it. She stopped then, or she apologized then, because her whole career was being
in trouble.
You know, melting away.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, she was getting a lot of publicity. But the real irony of it is that they lost a new a commercial on CNN that was starring Kathy Griffin.
Oh, right.
And she was selling a toilet, you know, and that was so bizarre. And she had to bleep out the words of what the purpose of toilets were. and so you know that they were so worried about her humor, and here was this I had never seen a toilet as the commercial that was selling. It was really bizarre. They saw it, and in the tweets that Donald Trump was sending out for this one, he said that he was ashamed of such a thing, what did it do for Donald Trump's son, 11-year-old Barron, who you know, that was shame. What was he to think about that? And that was really the hypocrisy, because all of the things that Trump was responsible for, you know, children in the airports who were taken away from their parents because they, you know, one thing after another,
truly obscene things. Yes,
in the health plans, there were children who didn't get. It was just one thing after another. There's I'd like to read just two paragraphs
sure.
About him that I want to read it because I want to get the exact words. All right? Is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Oh, of course it's all right. And if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive, and I'm very pleased and honored to have Paul Krassner with us, who had that magazine, The Realist, and understands about satire and intentional fake news and poking fun of power and how powerful that can be. Go ahead, Paul. I don't know if you have that ready.
Yeah, okay. When George W. Bush was elected president in the year 2000, it was due to the Electoral College, a rigged system which originally intended to prevent slaves from voting and evolved to gerrymandering. Even though Bush's opponent, Al Gore, won the national popular vote, Hillary Clinton was elected senator that year, and she announced that the first thing she would do was to get rid of the Electoral College. A few years later, as a columnist for the New York Press, I sent her a letter asking about the status of that promise. She didn't reply.
Yeah.
On November 8th, 2016, a crooked businessman, liar extraordinaire, bragging pussy grabber, make America white again, anti-choice, anti-Semite, fake Christian, climate change hoaxer, Twitter addict, homophobic,
yes.
apprentice politician, friendly fascist, and Vladimir Putin's useful idiot,
yes.
namely Donald Trump, who was elected as an insanely narcissistic dictator based on the Electoral College, whereas his opponent, Hillary Clinton, won the national popular vote by more than 3 million individuals galore to no avail. Irony lives, but an incredibly cruel monster has inadvertently awakened a sleeping population resisting with love and law. And so today, Trump may, in a few hours, he's going to perhaps not be part of the
climate change agreement
event in Paris,
yeah.
and that he would not want to see climate change. Admit that it's a human cause for that, and so it's only of all the countries on this globe, it would be the United States and Nicaragua and Syria.
Yes,
everybody, all of you know that's how out of it. But he doesn't want to disappoint his supporters. So to get back to your question about the yippies, it was 1966.
Okay.
No, 1966 in December, I was on a work vacation with Abby Hoffman and his wife Anita, and our work vacation was in Florida, in the Keys, and we were tripping on acid during a hurricane. We were looking out the window and watching all of the stuff swirling around in this hurricane. And then we had a black and white TV set there.
Of course.
And although for us,
yeah.
like we were, it was purple and orange.
Uh-huh.
And Lyndon Johnson, the president then, was talking about how he wanted to do his half in the war in Vietnam, and we realized that we had to go into in the 1968 that there was going
sure.
to be a convention in Chicago that these Democrats the Vietnam War was bipartisan but this happened to be at that point the Democrats who were on their watch, and so we decided that we would have a not the usual. While the politicians were doing their speeches and all of that, we would have what Phil Oakes, the folk singer, said, that a demonstration should turn you on, not turn you off. And so we went, we flew back to New York at Abby and Anita's home. We had a meeting of a lot of the local activists, and we were talking about what we wanted to do at a counter convention that we wanted to have, where there would be rock and roll music there instead of those speeches, and all kinds of events that would be part of the counter convention. But the police were under the impression that we were going to be violent, which we weren't. And when we went to get permits so that young people coming from around the country could be could sleep in the park, and they refused, even though if the Boy Scouts wanted to do that, they could do it. The mayor's, the deputy mayor, asked me as we were leaving, he said, "Come on, what are you really going to do there?" And I said, "Well, did you see that there was a movie where 14-year-olds were putting LSD into the reservoir?"
Right.
And he said, you know, that he took it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had National Guard people guarding the
drinking
reservoir.
Right.
But the thing is, when we had this meeting, I knew as a journalist that there had to be a who for the who, what, when, where, and why. And I went to the other room to try and think of something that would be a
who,
because there was this phenomenon of hippies who were smoking pot in the park, and there were political activists who wore suits and ties.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a kind of hybrid that came out of that, which was that they each had something in common, which had to do with the straight political protesters were they at first thought that, oh, these stoners just that they were
it'll detract,
not activists,
right?
But it turned out that they were
very much so.
By smoking in the park, that was a testing the law. They were, it was not going along with the anti-marijuana laws,
right?
And the stoners realized that if they were talking about peace and love, they had to also realize that there was a war going on the other side of the globe.
Yes.
And so there was this hybrid, and I came up with I knew that I went through something that would rhyme with hippies, and it went all through the alphabet, and finally came to the word yippies.
Oh, that's
and I
perfect.
Thought that would do it, and that was yip for short, and each so YIP you. Y was for youth, right. And it was a kind of
it was youth dominated.
It was for mostly young people.
Yeah.
The I was for international, because this was a worldwide evolutionary jump in consciousness.
Yes.
And things going on in Mexico and Paris and Czechoslovakia,
yeah.
around the globe, were all these protests against the war going on. And so that was the Y and the I, and the P was party, the Youth International Party, in both senses of the word.
Yeah.
You know, the Yippie Party and the party. So so that was the beginning of it. And there were different ways to prepare themselves for, you know, we had press conferences, and there was a group of these Yippies who went to the New York Stock Exchange.
Ah, yes.
And had a couple of hundred single dollars,
right,
that they dropped onto the floor, and all of these stockbrokers suddenly, they hadn't seen actual money, you know, it was all abstractions to them. And so they stopped yelling, pork bellies, and they would just change into dollars, picking them up. And then we went outside, and there were journalists there who had been waiting for us to come out, and we talked about that the reason was the relationship between the stock exchange was really related to the war. And you couldn't, and you know, decades later, when they're occupy the stock exchange, you know, it was just another form. But what happened in Chicago was that the police were they had tear gas,
yeah.
And this was at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I yelled at the cops, "Hey, come on! You're not supposed to tear gas on us until 11 p.m. But they did it early. There were journalists there who had brought tear gas masks
with
them, so that they never thought they would have to do that. But it was there was a government investigation of all of this, and they came to the conclusion,
right,
that this was a police riot.
And indeed it was.
So,
they lacked a sense of humor, I think. And
what?
I think the police and the authorities lacked a sense of humor. And
They were, you know, this was, they would see long-haired fellows who were walking around with young women. And they had, you know, men wearing beads. And it was just not the way they wanted to see their kids. So the police had they felt it was their own children had to be protected from these happy-go-lucky stoned people who were just a lot of having fun, and this was not, and you know, they were losing their you know,
their,
it was
progeny,
like a circus. These kids wanted to join the circus.
Yes, it was very, very attractive to young people. And it seems to me that, you know, that's part of what it is. You know, there's the SDS, very serious academic stuff that puts people to sleep. And in America, you know, the kids who were born in the 50s and 40s wanted fun. And Yippie became fun. And it was something that attracted people. And it was more than just reading and giving speeches. This was action. This was stuff you could see. And instead of explain, you had the Wall Street throwing the money down, nominating the pig for president. That told the story. And today, as it goes on, the obscenity, you know, as you're talking about Lenny Bruce, his alleged obscenity versus the war in Vietnam versus the incredible Jim Crow laws down south. And you know, which is really obscene. And I think that's one of the things that the realist and this whole thing at least includes. And I've heard it said that politics and protest, and you alluded to this before, are both necessary. Neither is sufficient. Millions of people have come out onto the streets again and again in resistance to Trumpism. People who have never been politically involved are fired up. And just as it seems as Nixon was our best anti-war organizer, I mean, we had to follow up on it, but he got people, you know, against the war. Is it possible that this Donald Trump, this Benito the Cheeto, as I call him, may be, in a way, the best organizer the left ever had? Is this starting to happen? I think it's, and it maybe it's carrying on. You know, us aging boomers, we're not leading the movement so much of the young. The millennials are doing that. I find it quite exciting. I wonder if they are a cultural mutation of us 60s people. What are your thoughts about where we are now and the role of satire and street actions in this whole struggle for getting back to good values?
Yeah, well, yeah, I agree that Trump, Trump being winning, and we were all shocked about it because to the last minute we thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win.
Oh, yeah.
He thought that, so there was a blessing in disguise because the day that he won the election, that was a shock, and everybody, you could see even the newscasters, that you know, they were all saying what. And so the next day when they had these marches along with all kinds of people who had never been active before, who never were at any kind of demonstrations, but they suddenly realized that they had they had to resist what was a nightmare, and you know, it was, and it also revealed how the Republicans were. You know, Trump was like a guy who lifted this huge boulder, rolled it over, and out came all the Republicans. You know, in lizard form, in snails, and in
scorpions,
coyote, whatever, everything just coming out from under that.
Yeah.
Because what Trump did was he said how he articulated what the Republicans, so many of them, felt that way, but they could never say it.
Yeah.
And
good point.
And so many of them still go along with him, although more and more they're seeing through them, and there are Republicans who realized that that they could see through him, and more people.
Yeah, we're getting it.
Excuse me, one half second.
Yeah, I think
I'm
we.
Sorry, I'm sorry. Back. So it was. You can see it growing all the time. Of people doing all kinds of resisting. It was you can see it going on, and the irony is that he was afraid said he was afraid of what Kathy Griffin did because of his 11-year-old son, Barron. That it was a shame, that look what he had to face. And I would like to write a letter to a young Barron and say, hey, you know, your father has done things that have hurt and shocked children your age. To see what your father has done, you know, when... I don't know how the kid must feel, you know, seeing so much that his father is going to be revealed as a criminal.
Yeah.
And so that's the blessing in disguise, because his whole business has been with mafia. He has done one thing after another as a businessman that he tried to do with his climate change. You know that it's a hoax.
Yeah.
And it's a shock that he would just do that. What happened was because he had white supremacists became his supporters.
Oh yeah.
There's Alex Jones, who is a total conspiracy nut, and Trump was on his TV show, and Alex Jones said to him, "You know, all my listeners, they love your work." And what Trump did was find all of these subcultures who never even bothered voting, that they became his support. Mm-hmm. And he said things about violence. He encouraged it.
Oh, yeah.
And people have been doing violent things now because
they're let loose.
Trump kind of said it's okay to do that. Not in so many words, but
right.
He was just so mean-spirited, it's still unbelievable.
And it is, and he can look, I suppose, sort of normal, and, you know, the presidential aura, I don't really see much of it. But the reality is, I mean, it's like, as you say, you know, truth is silly putty. It can be many different things. One reality is that people in Yemen, for example, are dying a lot, that people are dying around the world because of American actions, and Trump is clearly making it worse by he lifted up the rock over the military. You know, he's just turning them loose. He's not going to have a citizen say over military policies anymore, which is incredibly dangerous. And it's important for satire and for people to poke fun at it. And to because I find one of the great things about Yippie was, what can power do? When you laugh at power, they are powerless. They can't do anything about it. And if you just tuned in again, Paul Krasner is our guest today, one of the founders of Yippie, had the Realist magazine, looking back on 60s values, what's important from then, what we can learn from them. And one of the things that happened in 2016, of course, was the phenomenon of Bernie Sanders. People, his detractors, have called him an aging hippie. They mean it as a derision, yet he was and remains extremely popular. What are your thoughts about that, about Bernie Sanders and his popularity?
Oh, well, that's what I would have voted for.
He would have won. Oh, no doubt.
He was, you know, he was uncompromising. He knew of the injustice that goes on so many levels, and people saw that he was
for real
someone to be really the ideal that they could identify with. Although when Hillary Clinton won in the Democratic Party, there were a lot of the millennials who instead voted for Trump. And I remember Sarah Silverman just said how stupid they were.
Yes.
You know, which was courageous of her, but it had to be said, you know. And still people, you know, you see people get asked whether if they voted for Trump, and they'll parrot him. They'll say things like, "Well, because he's going to make great America great again."
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just and understandable, because they had felt that they were left out by the establishment.
Yep.
And to a certain extent, that
it's
was true.
Yes,
but he was not the answer to that. And but somehow he won, and with the Electoral College, but yep. He was such a liar, a liar. Like my favorite lie he did was when he said that Hillary started the birther movement and he ended it.
Yeah, doesn't matter.
As a satirist, it's hard. It's hard to realize it. You know, because it. Although you know, so many whether it's the night talk shows like Seth Meyers and Jimmy Kimmel, that they and Samantha Bee and Chelsea
Handler,
what's her last name?
Handler, I think. Yeah.
And there are all those people who are outspoken. Certainly, Alec Baldwin playing Trump.
Fabulous.
Saturday Night Live. You know, all of this adds up, and he is so thin-skinned that he has to, you know, do his tweets in the middle of the night and complain about, well, Saturday Night Live, they're not funny, you know. And the thing about him, because he's so narcissistic, that he is inside out, and so he would project his narcissism onto people. So he would say that Hillary was a crook, but he's the crook. He said that Bernie Sanders was crazy, but Trump was the crazy one.
Oh, yeah.
And one after another, he would say Ted Cruz, lying Ted Cruz, but he was the liar. You know, it was just projecting all of his characteristics onto people, because that was his narcissism was inside out. Like that.
He's so thin-skinned, and I do believe that one of the things that still motivates him is the National Press Club Association. A couple of years ago, he was there, and he was ridiculed, and I can tell, boy, that really got under his skin. If I just serious for just a minute here, looking at history, you know, that what is America? Who is really America? There's a terrific argument. Some say the founders wanted a fundamentalist Christian nature. Others say it was a structure like the mother country, aristocrats really running the show. And then there were pioneers giving us the myth, and I mean myth, of rugged individualism. Others insist it was the struggle of the debtors, the farmers and yeomen of the mini-revolts like the Shays and Whiskey Rebellions. Of course, it was a combination. My question to you, Paul Krassner, is back in the 60s and today, do you consider yourself and your fellow travelers as counterculture or really as culturally consistent patriots, perhaps in the mold of the debtors, the Shays Rebellion people, the Sam Adamses? Do you consider yourself kind of traditional patriotic Americans?
I mean, the First Amendment is, there was free expression before the First Amendment, but that codified it, the right to say what you want. Although there's now this woman who laughed at something that Sessions said, and she got busted for laughing at him. There's so much insanity going on, but there has always been a counterculture. It's just taken different forms, you know. Mm-hmm. There were the beatniks,
yes.
And then the hippies, and then the yippies, and then the punks, and then the hip hop. They all take different forms, but they're all
expressions of freedom.
They're increasing their own way of looking at the culture and trying to live their own alternative to that.
Yeah, and it's
not to be confused with alternative facts.
Yeah, it's got to be hard to be a satirist and have Trump as president. Just a quick one. The 60s was a liberating time. There was widespread optimism for the future. How optimistic are you for the future?
Well, I was at a benefit, and Harry Chapin, the singer-songwriter, was there. And backstage, you were talking about optimism. And he said a thing which has stayed with me. He said, if you don't act like there's hope, there is no hope. And so I still have hope. You know, maybe because I took too much acid, who knows? But
Well, acid is still alive for the future. I mean, the doctors are finally realizing that can be a very, very helpful tool if done under the right circumstances. And certainly a lot of my generation got a tremendous amount of real spiritual insights, I think, out of that stuff.
Yeah, well, that's what the counterculture in the 60s really was about. You know, it was true that there was sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yes.
But the core of it was a spiritual approach.
Yes.
That that instead of the Western religions, which had dogma, there was a kind of liberation of Eastern religions. So, and that was the New Age, and now there's a new Age.
That's true.
And, you know, the things that happened in the 60s where young people were doing organic farming, and now that's an industry, and that's great.
Yep. And the environment in so many ways. And I tell you, I see the kids these days, you know, the millennials, it's very exciting. I think they're carrying it forth. Hey, this has been great fun. How can people, you have a website, I'm sure, and there's that Disney comic thing on there, which is quite amusing.
Oh, yeah. The website is Paul Krassner. That's with two S's. Yes. PaulKrassner.com. And you can see the Disneyland Memorial Orgy poster on that. And
it's a lot of fun.
My autobiography, which was, I got the when the FBI called me a raving, unconfined nut, that's the name of the book, Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut. So I was very grateful to the FBI for giving me such a great title.
And I'm grateful for you for being with us today, Paul Krassner. Carry on, and thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much.